Well, we come now to Mark's Gospel again, and to Mark chapter 5, from where we left off in our studies on our last occasion here on Wednesday evenings. Mark chapter 5, New Testament, Matthew, Mark, in the New Testament, Mark chapter 5. And we'll read from verse 1 to the end of verse 20. This is the word of the Lord. They came to the other side of the lake, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him any more. Not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me. For he was saying to him, Come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And Jesus asked him, What is your name? He replied, My name is Legion, for we are many. And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, Send us to the pigs. Let us enter them. So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region as he was getting into the boat. The man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Thus far we read in God's holy and infallible word. Demon possession. You might care to note that as you travel through the Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, that the authors, and of course ultimately the author is the Holy Spirit of God, but it's worth noting that if a person is sick, the New Testament says they are sick. If a person is possessed with evil, it says that they were possessed with evil. It never ever confuses the two. There is a difference. But here, in this passage, we see that Jesus, he stills yet another storm. We saw him dealing with the elements in the previous passage, if you recall. Peace be still, and the wind ceased, and there was great calm. And here he comes, another storm, but of a different kind, one inside of a man, a human being, created by God to be loved and to love. And here I suggest to you is the greatest tragedy concerning human sin. is that men do not love their Creator as they should, and they do not love one another, and neither do they love themselves as they should do. But here we see again the saving and the delivering power of Jesus. And in the midst of this Jewish community, I point out the fact that it's Jewish because of these pigs. And I find myself asking the question, what are these Jews doing with pigs, with forbidden animals? Remember that this would be under the Old Testament dispensation, and the ceremonial laws would still be in force. It would be against Jewish law for these people to have pigs. And yet here they are, and there's a fair number of them. This is a fair-sized business, 2,000 pigs. This is a blatant disregard of God's law for them. So when you have a society, when you have a community that lives in blatant disregard for God's law, whether it be concerning marriage, whether it be concerning sexual immorality and God's laws against it, if a community is living in blatant disregard of God's law, is it any wonder that the younger generation coming up, that their lives are dominated by the powers of evil? The way that our own society operates today surely is an invitation to the powers of darkness to come in, invade and dominate our young people. And of course, as a result of this, well, this living light, you might say, or disregard to God's law, the younger community coming up amongst them are handed down the remnants of a lifeless religion, because this is what Judaism had become in the time when Jesus came amongst them. Not to mention the idolatrous, obsessive materialism of which we'll make mention in due course. But here is a man, he's in the grip of an evil spirit. His personality is overtaken, is totally and completely changed. Multiple demons, we're told, verse 9, Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Here is a man who has been invaded by demonic forces. Some people would charge Jesus with cruelty concerning the pigs that he casts the demons out of the man and into the pigs, and of course the pigs destroy themselves, they're drowned, and so some would say, well, this is animal cruelty. Well, all I can say is that if animals and the profits of a business are more important to you than the lives of a man who is being destroyed by the powers of evil, then our values have become somewhat distorted. Did Jesus not say in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 29 that we are of more value, you are of more value than many sparrows? Matthew 10:29, "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you're of more value than many sparrows." But first of all, in verses 1 to 9, we see the power of evil. We don't know how this man came to be dominated by evil, by these evil forces. Matthew, in his version, he tells us that there was two men. There might even have been more. Maybe did he, in his youth, was he trifling with evil? Involved in some particular kind of sin, maybe sorcery, drugs, I do believe that there are many people in the world today involved in drugs and drug taking, who because of that, their minds are left vacant, and of course they are susceptible to the spiritual powers of evil and darkness. But some kind of indulgence that left him trapped and led to him eventually being overtaken and dominated by the powers of darkness. Doubtless he never intended for that outcome. Nobody does. I recall witnessing to a woman in Manchester. We were working there in the streets, and she was telling me about her background. She was a woman of the street. She was destitute, and she was telling me, she said, there's hundreds of women in Manchester. She said, we sleep under motorway bridges and in shop doorways, some young girls, and she says, night by night, she says, that they're raped and abused by men in like circumstances. You look at some of the broken, derelict characters that wander the streets of our cities throughout England today, throughout the United Kingdom today. But none of these people, whatever it was that got them there, that took them to that place, none of them set out with that intention. You look at the man who's wasted with drunkenness or drugs. The woman who's lost because of her immorality, they never set out to become those things. But of course the question is, to where does this man go? To whom does he go to get help? Does he have remorse? Does he have regrets? Does he wish that he was out of this situation? Or maybe is he still rebellious? Maybe how can you help him if he doesn't want help? There are many, many people in our society, many people in this world today who are in that state and condition. And you look here at the powerlessness of society. And at the back end of verse 4, we're told here that no one had the strength to subdue him. Nobody could do anything with him. His life was marked with wildness, isolation, darkness, loneliness, suffering, fear. He's withdrawn. He's a dropout. A grotesque lifestyle in the midst of the tombs. And what can society do to help him? Nobody had the power to subdue him. Society was powerless to help this man. I don't know if any of you read the Huffington Post, but last week in that publication there was an article about our own society. It said that there was an awful malaise on our society. And it went on to speak about children in school sexually abusing one another, about the drug abuse. A malaise. That's one way of putting it. There was another article in the same paper about a young woman at the height of life, full of vivacity and life, and she died from an overdose of drugs because she was celebrating. Do you know what she was celebrating? She was celebrating the fact that she'd just gotten a job helping drug addicts. Yeah. But here's my point. The powerlessness of society to help our children, to help people in this state and this condition. All we get is nothing but political rhetoric. Modern society, you see, and your politicians, these These are your these are the elite. These are the Oxbridge brats, as I call them. You know? These are the powerful elite figures of our society that have fallen out of Oxford and Cambridge, who put all their strength, all their power into science. Science says this and science says that, so science must be right, must it? What can science do for this man? What can science do about the malaise on our society in England today? What can society do for that young woman over killed with an overdose of drugs? They have no answer to it. With all the modern developments of modern science, technology and medical science, they have no answer to evil. Society is powerless. So it was with this man. The penal system is powerless too. Look at verse 4. Look at the beginning of verse 4. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart. Lock him up. That's what some people say. He's a waster, you know. He wanders the streets. He's a nuisance. He's always crying out. Lock him up. Lock him up. That's the answer. But it wasn't the answer for this guy. I mean, maybe if we knew how it started, how he got into this, then maybe we could be on our guard. You know, we do all need to be careful, don't we? I mean, risks can be very, very costly. I was reading an account, two religious men. One of them, he had been trapped in lust for 10 years, and it led him to all sorts of filthy, dirty stuff that just short of adultery, you know. But he turned to another man who was the minister of a church looking for help, and he confessed to him. He felt that he needed to confess to somebody what he'd been doing. He was looking for help to get out of it. And the man whom he was confessing to, he broke down in tears. He was just absolutely wrecked, because he had exactly the same problem and worse than the man who was confessing to him. In fact, he had full-blown AIDS. He was about a step away from death. One gets the victory. The man who came to confess to him, he eventually got the victory over it, but the other one didn't. There are things the Apostle Peter tells us that war against our souls. 1 Peter 2 verse 11, Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Where does a person cross the line? Like the man who didn't get the victory, the one who had the AIDS. Where was the point where he crossed the line where God gave him over to it? Where was it that this man crossed the line and became so dominated by the powers of darkness and evil? Whatever this man's case, he's not free. But the chains are no answer. He just snaps them, he just breaks them. Lock him up, people say. Along with all the others, and what happens? They all get worse together. They teach one another more and more evil. The penal system is powerless to help these people. It does them no good at all. And of course, well, he's personally powerless. He can't help himself, because the flesh is of no help at all against spiritual wickedness in high places. John 6 verse 63, Jesus says, it is the spirit who gives life. The flesh is no help at all. The flesh is just that. That's our natural being, you know. We came from our mothers and fathers. You know, we were born naturally speaking, Well, human nature, you see, especially against such evil as we're looking at here, is of no profit at all. I mean, we could tell them, fight it. Fight the evil in you. Work at it, man. Isn't that what these people, when they go to the social services and they go to the rehab centers, isn't this what they're told? Well, you've got to help yourself, you know. You've got to fight it, man. You've got to work at it. But they can't, for the life of them, they can't. Would that I could pull myself together, they say. Then, of course, with them who tell people that, you know, well, God only helps those who help themselves. If that's the case, then God help us all. Against the power of sin and Satan, we are all of us powerless. We are held captive, we are snared, and we are dying daily in our sin, tormented and chained to the misery of sin, just like this man. This is the very reason why Jesus was sent by his Father, why he had to come, because there is no one else who can set us free from the darkness of Satan, sin, and evil. No one. But verse 7, look at the power of Jesus. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Isn't it amazing that the very presence of Jesus provokes this reaction from the powers of evil? It's certainly the presence of Jesus draws the man to him and causes words of fierce rejection. Poor man doesn't know what he wants. Jesus asks him his name. That's not just an act of care, but it recalls, it kindles in him a sense of his identity. He doesn't know who or what he is anymore. He's living, you know, like worse than an animal. Recalling his sense of humanity, he's a human being that matters to God. He's a human being with a human soul. You know, he's a person with value. But you see, isn't this something else that your modern society, with its modern science, it just totally devalues humanity? Is it any wonder that we're in the state that we're in, the hardened, callous state that we're in our society today? You've got doctors and nurses, you've got medical science that doesn't recognize that human beings have souls anymore. They don't believe that a child in its mother's womb is a child. It's just a fetus. It's just something to be destroyed at will if you so choose. It's not a human being. They have destroyed human identity and value. God made you in love, and he made you to be loved, to love him and know his love, of more value than many sparrows. Nobody had spoken to this man like this in such a way for a long time. In the eyes of society, he was just a waster. He was worthless. But Jesus is identified once again by the powers of evil. The demons within the man, it's they who speak when he bids them to come out of him. Jesus, Son of the Most High God, the theology of demons, absolutely right. Their theology is perfectly right. Jesus, Son of the Most High God. The powers of darkness know this. But you see, you can know that and still not be saved. It has to go further than that. You have to trust in Him to save you. Jesus, the Son of the Most High God. Jesus means Savior, the power to save. That's what His name means. And of course here He solved the man's problem. He set him free from the demonic forces and gave him a new life. This is the same Jesus who came to bring salvation to the world by virtue of His death and resurrection. This is what the Bible is about from beginning to end. No, it's not a scientific treatise, but it is scientifically precise. It's not a history book, but yet it is precise in its history. It's a book about salvation. The Old Testament is about how God would send His Son into the world, that through Him that the world might be saved. The New Testament's the record of Him coming, of Him dying and rising again, that we might be saved. Salvation from a certain and known danger, the powers of darkness and evil that hold sway over the world and over us. Jesus with the ability to do what society is powerless to do what the penal system is powerless to do, and to do what we ourselves are powerless to do. Hebrews 7:25, consequently, He, Jesus that is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through Him. For this man it meant forgiveness. It meant that the power of sin was broken and that he was freed from Satan's rule. That's salvation. That's what Jesus came for. Not all the powers of society put together, and not the power of the penal system, and not all the self-help in the world can do that. Only Jesus. Only the Savior. But He has the power to deliver. He's the Son of God, the demons tell us. And this is seen, of course, immediately with the immediate deliverance of this man. Here he is, verse 15, and he's right-minded. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And of course they were afraid. We see it in the pleas of the demons, verse 12, and they begged Him, saying, send us to the pigs, let us enter them. They confess, the demons confess their powerlessness to do anything without the consent of the Son of God. Isn't that amazing? They can't do anything without divine permission. Because the one who is stronger than Satan is here, confronted by the one who commands 12 legions of demons. He's the king. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 4 says, for the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? The power to condemn, the back end of verse 7, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me. The powers of evil know what's coming to them. They know that their end is the lake of fire, utter damnation. But it's a reminder to us of what it is that we fight against, that it's not just against flesh and blood. Ephesians 6:10, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. You can't reason a man out of sin. You can't reason a man out of the clutches and the snare of the powers of darkness. You can't even reason your way into God. It is only by faith that these things are understood. We ourselves are powerless against these forces of darkness. We are weak, all of us, sinful with many infirmities. But here we have a strong friend in the one who triumphed over the powers of darkness in his cross. Colossians 2:13, and you who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by cancelling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. And in all believers, if this power is for you, I ask you, the power of Jesus I mean, if this power is for you, then who or what can be against you? But if this power of Jesus is against you, I ask you, then what have you got to, what have you got going for you? Nothing at all. But in verses 14 through 20, the power of prophet. The herdsmen have no interest in what's done for the man. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man and the one who had the legion sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. They just fled. They had no interest in what was done for the man. Isn't this amazing? Wouldn't you think that everybody would be, you know, just absolutely delighted, made up? Here's this guy, you know, he's been a waster. His life is wrecked. Everybody's afraid of him. They won't go near him. And here he is, clothed in his right mind. Here he is, made well, and nobody bats an eyelid. They're not in the least bit interested. Maybe the herdsmen, maybe they're afraid that they've lost their jobs because the pigs have gone. Everybody comes to see this disaster that's taken place. A man, right-minded and listening to Jesus and enjoying every minute of it. Huh? And their reaction is fear. They were afraid of the man when he was wild, and now they're afraid when he's been made calm. I suggest to you that this is idolatrous materialism. All they're concerned about is their pigs. All they're concerned about is their business. Religion, powerful though it is, that brings financial loss and economic slump, well, we've got no place for that, have we? Notice, will you please, the intensity with which they beg Jesus to go. And they began to beg Jesus, verse 17, to depart from their region, please, out of it, we don't want this stuff here. Thank you very much. Maybe perhaps there were other pigs in the region. What will happen if Jesus finds them? Will they too be destroyed? Or maybe it's conviction. Maybe they're convicted. They realize what they're doing is against God's law. But it's amazing how people actually see, perceive, when they hear, when they witness the power of Jesus to save and to transform human lives. And they beg him to go. I remember the case speaking to a young man in Hanley when I was preaching there. He'd been on drugs for years, thieving and doing all the stuff that goes with the drugs, and he got saved. He got saved. Jesus delivered him, released him from his drug addiction, and made him a brand new man. And he went home to his mother, told his mother what had happened to him. You know what she said? "Get out of here," she said. "Get out of here. I preferred you when you were on drugs." You know? That's this community. Go. We don't want you here. And of course, well, it's the business, you know. It's material. That's all that matters. Financial gain. And so their rejection of Jesus is an invitation to Satan. Maybe they decided that the social services couldn't help this man, so nobody could. But Jesus did. But of course, this is beyond their understanding. And if something's beyond their understanding, we don't like it. We like everything to be, you know, compact, fit into our minds. And if it doesn't fit, you know, with our thinking, if it's, you know, beyond us, then it's unacceptable. Perhaps maybe they like things the way that they were. You know, their religion too, that accommodated their disobedience, dead, lifeless, powerless religion. You wouldn't believe the number of people that are quite content with that. And were Jesus to break in amongst them, boy, you would see their displeasure. Go, go, we don't want this. Life-transforming religion. We like things the way they are. It's called prejudice. Religious prejudice even. But of course, denying the power of God and rejecting God's Son. John chapter 3, "He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth belongs to the earth and speaks in an earthly way. He who comes from heaven is above all. He bears witness to what he has seen and heard, yet no one receives his testimony. Whoever receives his testimony sets his seal to this, that God is true. For he whom God has sent utters the words of God, for he who gives, he gives the Spirit without measure. The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life. Whoever does not obey the Son shall not see life. But the wrath of God remains on him." You see, in rejecting God's Son, they open themselves up to the powers of darkness, the forces of evil. It's like when a man, a person, or even a society opens itself up to this philosophical thinking that there is no God. They open themselves up to the powers of darkness. So you see, looking for prosperity, you know, as many people are in our society today, that's the be-all and end-all of everything, isn't it? Prosperity. Or drowning your conscience in drink and, well, no mind for God and no mind for holy things. But look at the change. Look at the transformation in this man. Look at this plea of a different kind in verse 18. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. He wants to join the disciples. This is the normal effect of salvation. When a person gets saved, gets right with God, they want to be with Jesus and they want to be with the followers of Jesus. He's moved with a loving gratitude because of what's been done for him. But Jesus gives him an even more challenging ministry. Verse 19, he did not permit him but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." Go back to the community that knew him best, that knew him as he was before, and let them see the change. And let him testify, "It was Jesus who did it for me." And he did, and all the people marveled. What do you think some of them said? "It won't last. He'll be back in the tombs before long." Others waiting with anticipation for him to fall. But it didn't happen. The Decapolis. Verse 20, he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marvelled. Back there, the Potteries is known as consisting of 5 towns. The Decapolis is 10 towns. Yeah? "Go back. Go," he says, "to the Decapolis, to the 10 towns. That's enough for any preacher. Jesus, you see, wasn't denying him. He was leaving behind, in these 10 towns, he was leaving behind a diligent preacher. And the effects of his witness were not negligible, because we'll hear, as we go through Mark's Gospel, we'll hear more later about the Decapolis. Jesus returns there and he finds many, many ready hearers. Someone had been sowing seed. And we believe it was this man from whom these demons were cast. If there's no seed sown, there can be no harvest, no salvation, no revival. But what is it that we seek for? Huh? These people in this community, they sin against the light. Jesus comes in his saving, transforming, delivering power, and they reject him. They want rid of him. They sin against the light of God. This society of ours needs to be careful that it doesn't sin against itself and sin itself into atheism and infidelity. If we reject the truth that would set us free, sinning angels, demons, sinning angels cannot stand before him. How do we think for one moment that we on that last and great day would be able to stand before him if they can't? Instead of, like these people, begging Jesus to depart, rather beg him that you be with him in that day. And not found to be against him. Jesus came to deliver us, to deliver this man and to deliver us all from the powers of darkness. John, in 1 John 5 and verse 19, says that the whole world is under the sway, the influence that is, of the evil one. We are all, to some extent, greater or less. Without Jesus, we're under his sway, his influence. And we all need to be forgiven. We need to be delivered. We need to be cleansed. and made right with God. And it's only the presence and the power of Jesus, the Son of the Most High God, who can do that for us. By calling upon His name for grace, for the favour and for the mercy of God. Whoever calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. God's shall is a promise from the God who cannot, does not, and will not lie. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Amen. Sing as we come to a conclusion this evening, then, number 490.